Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours.
KFC's.
Yeah.
There's a Pizza Hut. There's a Burger King. McDonald's. There's... I think there's a Wendy's in there. Everything you could need. Designer clothes, designer... Place for designer watches, designer bags. Yeah, the last thing that you'd expect to see operational in the middle of a humanitarian crisis. So in here you'll find things like toothpaste, tissue, toilet paper, hot sauce, a bunch of things that CNN says doesn't exist in Venezuela.
What kind of people would you say are shopping here? Is this the upper class, the middle class?
Mostly middle class. This shop is fairly well known for having reasonable prices. Maybe not the cheapest around, but reasonable prices.
Yeah.
Being well supplied.
So corporate media would say that the people here are just actors.
It's a lot of actors.
March 13th, 2019. Thank you for joining me yet again. I wanted to begin with that excellent video from Eva Bartlett on the ground, showing you yet another example of all the things they're saying, at least in part, are not all-inclusive. I'm always willing to acknowledge that there's probably some shelves that are empty and people that are suffering probably everywhere. There's definitely some in the United States I could point out. But the reality is that they're not showing you that that is part of the story, as well as the fact that apparently all these people must be actors because it doesn't fit the narrative. Now, the lies are everywhere. They really aren't. If you watch this show, you're well aware of this. The lies are everywhere in every story they present. Yet this time, with the latest destructive regime change war, it seems Americans are largely not falling for it. And that's due to the efforts of independent media, and your part in that as well, in exposing their seemingly lazy and incompetent efforts to deceive the masses. So today I will go over a 2010 memo from the organization that actually trained Juan Guaido from Gray Zone, which literally outlines exploiting the very electrical systems associated with the recent outage, coincidence, I'm sure, in Venezuela, of course, and the new U.S. shift to apparently declaring and just a seeming open war on socialism, I would say, because their efforts are failing in regard to demonizing Maduro. So now they just say, well, socialism's bad. That seems to stick. Let's go with that. I'll go over yet another anti-Semitism-focused bill, this time in Florida, and the Gallup polls, you know, if you're familiar with Gallup polls, the Gallup polls' recent attempt to utterly misrepresent the American public's support for Israel. Something I recently covered, the story being that it's the decade low for Israel, but even that was incorrect, and I'll show you why. And the CIA is being exposed, again, for making more deals with ISIS, and even the CIA breaking into the North Korean embassy in Spain and holding people hostage. Lots to get into today. But first, some breaking news that I saw right before I went live that I know you would be interested in hearing. And I haven't actually been covering the development of this, and I'll show you why. But according to the Associated Press, Senate votes to end U.S. support for Yemen war with SJ Resolution 7. It's been developing, but I tend to try to wait for these things to actually take effect, for it actually to be worthy of reporting. And, you know, because clearly we know that this still has to pass the House, and still Trump has vowed to veto anything in regard to Yemen, which should say a lot in and of itself. But here is why, really, I feel like this bill is another political theater, right? It doesn't mean we shouldn't support it. I support it only because it is drawing attention to what's really going on there, and that the U.S. does not have the legal justification to be carrying out this war, which is what this bill really gets into, you know, briefly, pointing out that they need a declaration of war and Congress needs to be involved. But here is why it's going to fail, just like the last one. It clearly says that this does not apply to any actions in regard to fighting Al-Qaeda, which is patently absurd. Especially when you know, when you watch this show, when you understand that the United States is currently working with Al-Qaeda in Yemen, as well as working with Al-Qaeda in Syria, or probably everywhere for that matter, and using them as the classic scapegoat, as we're going to get to more in a moment about Israel and Hamas and all that, or we did actually yesterday in regard to using these groups as the excuse, even though you've created them for invading these countries. The reality is that all they have to do is shift away and say, well, okay, well, now we're fighting Al-Qaeda and everything can maintain the same. That's written into that like that for a reason. And as I've pointed out countless times, I had Hussein al-Bukhadi on the show pointing out that four members of the Hadi government that the U.S. wants to put in place in Yemen are currently on U.S. lists of sponsoring terrorism. So just understand that this is a ridiculous thing to say for the United States to adhere to, and they still pretend that they're fighting Al-Qaeda all over the world. So this is why I think it's going to fail. But breaking news, the Senate did pass it. But again, it has to still pass the House, and Trump has vowed to veto it. So ultimately, I don't think we're going to get anywhere with this. But good to know that he's drawing attention to Yemen. But let's start today by exposing some more Venezuela fake news. What do you say? Seems like kind of a new pastime for the T-Lab show is exposing all the ridiculous lies, specifically about Venezuela, because there seems to be no shortage of it. Here's a tweet that basically it translates to, and you can actually see the translation there, to actually saying, dismantling fake news again. Dozens of means, and this is a poor translation, but I'll just read it directly. Dozens of means of disinformation in voices of info mercenaries. So dozens of people speaking disinformation, info mercenaries, repeated the same things, that with no more power than in Caracas, they were seizing water from a sewage river. And this is what the video actually shows you. But this video in this link, which is in the show notes, you can watch for yourself, proves it was all a vile lie, that it was actually spring water. And this is true, by the way. I've done my research. The reality is that this is just yet another social media pop-up example of propaganda trying to spread the idea. Oh my God, these people are suffering so bad. Look at them. They're getting water from sewer water. It turns out it was a spring water. But the reality is there's so much fake news flying around specifically about Venezuela, and they're just getting sloppy with it. They just don't care because as long as they get some people to get on their agenda, I guess they think it's a win, but it seems like more people aren't, that it's losing today. And it makes me feel good about what we're doing. I mean, they're just not used to getting so much pushback. And it makes their efforts and rhetoric seem, I mean, it's already seeming cartoonish as it really, really is. And it's getting worse with every passing day. And I think because they're getting more desperate. For instance, after the outage, Guaido accused the Maduro government of turning the blackout during the night into a horror movie with his gangs terrorizing people, which is possible. I mean, there are maniacs out there. There are people like, it's the same kind of absurd narrative of saying Assad is just bloodthirsty, just wants to gas people because he's a villain, even though there's no evidence to support that. Saying that Maduro used the outage to go out and just hurt people because he's so bad. It falls flat. It does not ring true, especially with all the other information that contrasts this. Now, for the first story that is really important, this isn't necessarily a new story. I've actually referenced this already once, but somebody sent this to me yet again, and I really wanted to point this out because this is really important, especially in regard to the outage. And it's just, you know, for those that don't want to believe the U.S. is involved, add it to the growing list of at least 10 plus things I can point out that are coincidence if you choose to look at it like that. This coming from Gray Zone, U.S. regime change blueprint proposed Venezuelan electricity blackouts as watershed event for galvanizing public unrest, which basically means it's on record where they outlined exactly what they need to do to galvanize public unrest, and the watershed event would have been exploiting electricity blackouts in Venezuela. Interesting how exactly that's what happened. I'm sure it's all a big coincidence, and I'm sure that people, because this memo came from the group that trained Guaido, I'm sure it's even more of a just big coincidence. But the U.S.-funded CANVAS organization stands for the Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies. The U.S.-funded CANVAS organization that trained Guaido, which in case you didn't already know that, Guaido was trained by U.S. regime change groups around the world, but those that they trained Guaido the Canvas Group, and his allies for that matter, they produced a 2010 memo, literally on exploiting electricity outages, and urged the opposition to, quote, take advantage of the situation towards their needs. I mean, you can't, it's, again, it's just, they don't think you're going to see this stuff. Now, the 2010 memo, in this memo, Canvas's Popovic, the person's name is Popovic, declared, quote, a key to Chavez's current weakness is the decline in the electricity sector, which first of all points out that, yes, there are issues with the electricity sector, which I don't think anyone has said is not true. There's also pretty strong issues in this country you could point at, but no one likes when you could do that when you compare the U.S. But Popovic explicitly identified the Simón Bolívar hydroelectric plant as a friction point, the literally same point that we're talking about that's currently given the issue. It's outlined in 2010 as the most important point. Coincidence. Emphasizing that, quote, water levels at the Guri Dam, the one we're talking about, are dropping. And Chavez, this is back when Chavez was in power, has been unable to reduce consumption sufficiently to compensate for the deteriorating industry. Which is something that many countries deal with, issues like this. But, you know, it doesn't mean it's okay. But the reality is there is clearly some kind of an issue that they were and are dealing with. But this is why they chose to exploit it. Now, speculating on a, quote, grave possibility that some 70% of the country's electricity grid could go dark as soon as April 2010, and I believe it's actually 80% today, the Canvas leader stated that, quote, an opposition group would be best served to take advantage of the situation and spin it against Chavez and towards their needs, which is exactly what the U.S. is doing, using it, spinning the story, and using it for their own agenda. U.S. groups who wrote this. Funny. Now, flash forward to March 2019, and the scenario outlined by Popovic in this exact memo is playing out almost exactly as he had imagined. Now, on March 7th, just days after Guaido's return from Colombia, where he participated in the failed and demonstrably violent February 23rd attempt to ram a shipment of U.S. aid across the Venezuelan border, the Simón Bolívar hydroelectric plant experienced a major and still unexplained collapse. Now, if you can ignore all of the coincidences in this story, again, that's a choice on your part to not see what's really happening. This is abundantly clear that this was planned, outlined, sabotaged, carried out, and used just like they're outlining in this documentation. Coincidences do happen, but personally, I don't usually believe in them. Now, another narrative which recently set the mainstream media ablaze is the claim that Cuba is now meddling in Venezuela, which is certainly possible. But as an ally of Venezuela, it's, you know, not so much meddling as cooperation. But when U.S. adversaries work together, you know, to thwart U.S. imperialism, they name that meddling. Now, according to the blindly regurgitated government version of the event that mainstream media dutifully reported, quote, forces of democracy were not able to overthrow the Venezuelan government, which is, you know, for democracy overthrow doesn't really work, because its political elite is controlled by Cuban intelligence services. President Donald Trump even said Maduro is nothing more than a Cuban puppet. Funny how this is continuing to evolve into something new every day. Now, considering the already existing U.S. allegations about the presence of Iran controlling Maduro, Hezbollah controlling Maduro, Russia controlling Maduro, or just about anyone that they feel might make Americans more open to invasion, it seems Venezuela is becoming another Syria, where in the U.S. narrative and perceived justification for their illegal actions kind of seems to change by the hour, with the usual lack of any discernible evidence whatsoever to support these claims. Now, we see this happening in a similar vein as China offers to help Venezuela restore power as Maduro accuses Trump and Guaido of sabotage. Well, China seeking to help Venezuelans, looks like by the U.S.'s use of the word, China's meddling in Venezuela, which again is certainly possible, but the reality is they're helping people at least surface level, which is the absolute opposite of what you can see happening between the U.S. and Venezuela. Now, China offered on Wednesday to help Venezuela repair its power grid, which I'm sure they're going to have a benefit. They're not just altruistic. China's doing this to a benefit of their own. I can guarantee it, but they're also actually offering to help repair the power grid, which is important. Now, speaking in Beijing, China, Foreign Minister spokesman Liu Kang said China had noted reports that the power grid had gone down due to a hacking attack. So even China now is kind of getting hip to what actually happened. It says, quote, China hopes that Venezuela's side can discover the reason for the issue as soon as possible and resume normal power supply. China is willing to provide help and technical support to restore Venezuela's power grid. That's that. Thank you for the super chat, by the way, Norm. I appreciate it. And he said my deep investigation is appreciated. I appreciate all of you for being here. But it's important to see this, that China is now offering to help. And I'm sure they have a benefit in doing so. But they're also pointing out that they can smell. They sense something. They see that there was something that happened. A hacking attack or whatever they want to call it. And they're willing to get to the bottom of it. That should be alarming to American, or rather U.S. government officials who were behind this. Because I think now that there's another superpower involved, such as China, and they actually find some evidence, that's going to be a big problem for the United States. So now, with U.S. efforts visibly failing, and they are visibly failing, they have decided to shift into an ideological war. And that should alarm you. Which I should not have to point out is in no way whatsoever a legally legitimate justification to just overthrow a sovereign nation because they don't believe what I believe. Love it or hate it, no nation has the legal right to invade a country because it's a socialist nation or just because they have different beliefs. This is literally the mindset behind the worst genocides in history. And here we are, now openly waging an ideological war, a war, I might add, on yet another idea, such as the war on terror, seemingly a war that can never really end. Is this maybe the new war on terror? Is this what we're seeing develop? A shift away from their failing other agenda, and it's going to be the war on socialism we might see? Who ultimately knows? But understand that a war on an ideology should be alarming to you. And this is now literally what we have the U.S. saying. Coming from anti-media, U.S. presents socialism as the real enemy in Venezuela, not just Maduro. Now, this is clearly because their efforts have been failing. They're not getting the support they need. The military's not on their side. The U.S. citizens are not on their side, not the majority. The majority of Venezuelans are not on their side, and the majority of the world is not on their side. So they figure, okay, we need to switch up our game here. Socialism seems to be at least partially, you know, a lot of people seem to be talking about that specifically. Let's just switch to that. That's my take from this. But to wait, or it could be this was what it was all along. And now they just kind of shed what's not working and went with what they're really trying to do, which is annihilate this ideology. And again, think of all the terrible things that have been waged in the name of Christianity that saw more people than we'd like to recognize die throughout history, or any religion, or any idea. This is what we're looking at. And again, it should really be alarming to all of us. Now, clearly the Trump administration has committed to seeing a regime change in Venezuela. I think we can see that. Now, in hopes of ultimately, I think, forcing into place opposition leader Juan Guaido, even though he seems to be utterly floundering in what he's trying to do, you know, because he's seen as more friendly to U.S. interests with oil and everything else they're doing in this country, letting them just take what they want. And of course, more friendly to U.S. interest at the direct expense of the very population the U.S. pretends to be fighting for. But that's a whole other story. Now, previous talk of Maduro as a gangster in and of itself is starting to fall by the wayside. Clearly not sticking, as I've been pointing out, as they had hoped. Instead, officials, particularly Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, are presenting the enemy in Venezuela as just socialism in general. Clearly making this an ideological fight. Now, this somewhat changes the tone, if not the intentions altogether, of the U.S. push for regime change, centering this whole thing not just on ousting a single government or a leader, but demanding Venezuelans as a whole, abandon its present ruling ideology in favor of one more palatable specifically to U.S. interests. How is that possibly something that would be okay with the rest of the world? Now, that's a much different demand. And makes Venezuela's decision to expel the U.S. diplomats from Caracas less surprising. This adds to constant U.S. threats to resort to invading Venezuela militarily to impose regime change. Pompeo presented the U.S. diplomats as a constraint on policy that is no longer in place, suggesting, as many would point out, that they're possibly nearing the point of intervention and just getting these people out of the way. Those ambassadors are no longer a useful tool, so it's time to move on to the real effort. Now, the New York Times seemed to be backing up the argument that the U.S. should escalate the situation, arguing that having backed Guaido and failed to get him into power could be similar to President Obama not following through on 2012 threats against Assad, which is a ridiculous thing to point out. Two things, actually. One, that, of course, the New York Times has had two stories lately that seems to challenge the U.S. narrative, but that should not let you think you should be able to trust the New York Times. That is on purpose. I don't know why, but It's damage control, and maybe this is why. But the point is, the New York Times is playing the game, and clearly they're part of the regime change machine. But to point out that, oh, Obama should have just annihilated Assad back then, is actually contradicted by the reality of events right now today. But see, what's the important thing to recognize is their version of reality is different from what reality actually is. That's why they continue to say, Assad gassed his own people, and all these claims that are very clearly debunked, even by the UN's own information, but they just continue to say it. And so now they're saying, well, we better get Maduro out of here before he gasses his own people like Obama let happen. It's a ridiculous comparison, and they know that. Now, this seems likely to just encourage President Trump on a military path, determined not to look weak. And you know that makes sense in regards to Donald Trump, and this should be alarming to all of us. And with an expected second attempt, which is coming, on just March 7th, I believe they were already claiming they were shipping more aid over there to Colombia. But with this expected second attempt to stage U.S. aid delivery provocations on the Colombian-Venezuelan border, it's really becoming clear that chances of a U.S. like direct military action to bring Guaido into power, their own political puppet, is beginning to grow at the very least. Now, another indication that actions are now being taken to actually silence those who might be able to maybe expose the truth during whatever upcoming actions the U.S. has planned, we're now seeing more people be censored, including officials in the Venezuelan government. This tweet says, this is obvious censorship by Twitter. It says the account for the office of the Venezuelan presidency hasn't been able to tweet in nearly 24 hours. Other Chavista media accounts experienced the same this week. This is something that is continuing, and think about this in regard to what we've seen other journalists in Venezuela, journalists in Iran, journalists in Yemen, journalists in Syria, how these social media groups align with the government to just ban whoever they point to. And that's something we need to recognize, that they're working in tandem. And here's the tweet that she's referencing here. It says, Twitter support, somebody responded the same thing to to her tweet. It says, why have you restricted this Venezuela official account? You know, while not taking any actions against the U.S. official account, Mike Pompeo, for breaking Twitter rules. That's a very good question. And of course, they're linking to the same, they're linking to this tweet, which links to Secretary Pompeo, Mark Pompeo's tweet saying, no food, no medicine, no more power, no Maduro. Clearly a threat. And she's saying, why don't you take action against this account, which repeatedly violates Twitter's rules? Targeted harassment, incited hatred, threatening with violence. Is this U.S. official above the rules? Obviously. But how funny it is to see Jack on Rogan's podcast literally outlining how this is exactly what will get you booted off Twitter. But of course, they're not going to ban the U.S. officials for doing what they're the plan is to overthrow countries and take their resources. Twitter is a guilty part of all of this. And here's an even better example of exactly the same thing. Tweeting out an open threat against Maduro, suggesting this is what's going to happen to him. And of course, WikiLeaks responds, because nothing says human rights like gloating over a human being getting sodomized to death with a bayonet. Well placed, WikiLeaks. It's just disgusting to see, but they're censoring politicians in Venezuela now. How is that possibly something that is okay with Americans? Now, on a brief note on the idea of censorship, my video from yesterday has been processing on YouTube's back end for over 24 hours now, which dramatically reduces its reach and its all the different stuff. And the point is that talking about these topics also gets you suppressed. And I think this is apparent. For those that still laugh when people say things like that and think it's a conspiracy theory, you're apparently not even watching what these outlets are saying themselves, which is that they openly censor things that they deem to be fake news or conspiracy theory. It's commonplace today. And now they're going even as far as to simply outright block politicians they don't agree with. This should show you above and beyond that whether all of them involved in these groups and Twitter or Facebook are part of the problem, or there's people at the top. Someone involved in this is part of the problem. And it's connected to the government. And that's a very clear reality that we need to come to terms with. Now, finally, before I move on to Israel, there's some stuff to talk about today with anti-Semitic bills and more going on with them in general. I wanted to point out what one person asked me on Twitter that just, makes too much sense for the average person to consider. And it says, isn't it weird that Trump hasn't done a thing to help 40 million Americans in poverty? 29 million without health insurance, 500,000 living on the streets, or entire cities without clean water, you know, like Flint, Michigan. Yeah, that's still a thing. But suddenly, he cares so much about humanitarian aid to Venezuela that he's willing to start a war. Yeah, you know, that's just too, that just makes too much sense for people today, so we'll just move on. I find those things humorous. Now, for this story coming from Anti-War, which is kind of a follow-up to what we were, a story that I recently did about a Gallup poll in regard to support for Israel being the lowest in a decade for American support, the public, not the government. Well, this story just got a little more interesting. According to the poll, only 22.2% in U.S. sympathize more with Israelis. Excuse me. Now, Israeli government is what this is implying. Not the average, just the individuals, but we're talking about the agendas of the government. And the poll turns out that the Gallup themselves just clearly, just utterly misrepresented the reality of the poll. And again, that shows you the how anything can be manipulated, including polls that people like to throw around, including this poll right here. But I think with everything else we're seeing, that it is beginning to materialize, that people are beginning to shift, at least wake up to the realities of these crimes being committed. Now, on March 6th, Gallup claimed that 59% of Americans sympathized more with the Israeli government and their actions over Palestinians, and only 21% sympathized more with the Palestinians. Yet, despite Gallup's claims, apparently, it turns out that most Americans have no opinion. And here's the poll they shared in the article. This is very interesting. So all that turned into all of a sudden being everyone supports Israel. But in reality, most people, and this is a dramatic shift away from what it was just a year or a couple years ago, being that most people supported Israel, or over the Palestinians, I should say. And this shows you that this has shifted so strongly that now people aren't even sure. They don't know that no opinion could also mean I'm not sure, because that's not on there. And I find that to be a very big deal. Now, the majority of Americans, 52.5%, far from expressing overwhelming but obviously declining sympathy for Israel, claim that they hold no opinion. Now, only 22.2% of Americans said they sympathize more with Israelis. This amount is less than the total number, 25.3%, of the Americans answering neither both and Palestinians, all of those combined. The Palestinians' response was just 6.8%. Which shows you still that it's sad that most people don't have understand enough what's going on in Palestine, but it shows you that things are slowly shifting. There is clearly a shift taking place. Erdogan, I literally just saw this before I went live. Erdogan just said openly in a rally, he called Netanyahu a tyrant who massacred Palestinian babies. Not that we should be trusting or even listening to Erdogan, but this is, it's interesting. Erdogan being the president of Turkey, for those that might not know. Now, of course, while Americans are increasingly less supportive of Israel, government agendas are this is what our politicians are doing, which is passing more anti-Semitism bills. This one is in Florida. But the whole percentage, the reality of the percentages need to show us very clearly that one, information's always being misrepresented, and two, that people are slowly pulling back and recognizing that they shouldn't just blindly support this group because their government tells them to. And that's very, very important. And now again, while Americans are clearly less supportive than ever, our politicians are more supportive than ever in passing literal bills that support a foreign government. If it was a bill about supporting anything about Russia, good God, it would be the biggest story of the decade. That's hypocrisy for you. This entitled Critics Say Anti-Semitism Bill Infringes on First Amendment by Banning Criticism of Israel, because it actually literally does. And interestingly enough, three judges have said the same, including federal Supreme Court judge. But, you know, we don't talk about that because already our politicians have ignored all three of those judges' ruling. You know, our precedent-based system and our legal system in this country, yeah, our politicians just ignored them. Half of these people are lawyers, for crying out loud, and they just don't care. The point is they don't care because they're doing what they're told, because they're influenced by Israeli government lobbyists. That's a simple fact. Now, Florida House Bill HB 741 is yet another example of U.S. politicians making it an unjust, I mean, it's an, making an unjustifiable focus to crack down specifically on anti-Semitism, not on just hate, but specifically anti-Semitism, even though there are already numerous laws on the books about racism and hate crimes in general. But no, we need a specific new law that says this one matters so we can use it to benefit Israel. That's what it's really about. The Israeli government is what we're talking about. Now, the bill is sponsored by Representatives Randy Fine, who's Jewish, and Michael Caruso, both who are Republicans. The co-sponsors are Representatives Jason Fisher, Chip LaMarca, and Spencer Roach, who are all Republicans. Now, fine, but that doesn't mean it's this support like this is all spectrums, both sides of the aisle. But I find it interesting lately that most of this stuff is coming from the Republican side. Now, Fine said the bill will do three main things. Quote, first thing that the bill will do is take the federal definition of anti-Semitism, the most widespread used definition, which I actually disagree with, of anti-Semitism in the world, and make it the Florida definition of anti-Semitism. Now, this is the point that we're always making. This is the intent, is to muddle the idea of anything against Israeli government actions being anti-Semitic, or even anti-Zionism being anti-Semitic, which is literally what they've included in this supposed most popular definition. Now, the second thing the bill does, he says, is to require all K-20 public institutions to treat anti-Semitism in the same way they treat racism on other college campuses, identifying the intersectionality of racism and anti-Semitism. Basically saying that anti-Semitism is its whole own thing. You can't just say racism is bad or hate crimes are bad, but racism is bad, but then anti-Semitism is really bad. Like, they're really outlining why this one is above all else, which more than ever shows you that in their minds, this class of people is more protected than anybody else. So they're different. They're special. It's important. This is what they want you to think. Everybody, and we're talking about a time when everyone's talking about tolerance and equality. They're literally outlining why this one group is different than everybody else and needs more protection. Now, everybody gets attacked. The reality of making this the one thing that we have to care about more than anything else is political. And we really need to see that. Now, he goes on to say, and the last thing is that it says that it comes to our education policy. You can't discriminate on religion of any kind as it relates to our public education institutions. Again, which, by the way, is already enforceable law. So they're outlining things that we already have laws in the books. And the point is, it's not about the law. It's about making this about Israel. Now, the bill also cites what it calls, quote, examples of anti-Semitism related to Israel, which, of course, includes, quote, blaming Israel for all interreligious or political tensions. So blaming them for things that they're doing, I guess, is off the table. Quote, focusing peace or human rights investigations only on Israel. So let me get this straight. So let's say hypothetically in a situation where only Israel's breaking the law, now you're just not allowed to call them out. So somebody else also has to be breaking the law for you to be able to call it Israel. I mean, think about the inherently ridiculous nature of what that says. It says, quote, in modern times, this is the important part, anti-Semitism is sometimes disguised as anti-Zionism, anti-Israel, but the two often overlap. See, and they show you their cards right at the end. You can't be against the Israeli government because they'll call you anti-Semitism. You can't point out the crimes of a Zionist-controlled government because you're anti-Semitic. And there's no overlap in their minds in that regard. That is what this is all about. This is what your U.S. politicians are doing on the federal level and the state level. Now, I believe this will be 27 states in our country that make it illegal to boycott Israel. I mean, think about that. That if you're a company, you have to literally pledge not to boycott Israel. I mean, that not only is that unconstitutional, but this authoritarian. And should be alarming to all of us. Now, remember, this largely stems from Ilhan Omar's obviously correct statements about AIPAC, not Jews, but AIPAC, and their influence on U.S. policies and politicians, which is a simple fact. All lobbyist groups, their literal job is to influence policy. But it showed you their hand when they flipped out about her pointing out that obvious point. But this reason this had blown up is because of her statements. And we should note that it's obvious and on record that they even know that they do so. This will be in the show notes, caught on tape, boasting that its money influences Washington. Literally what Washington just lost it over and made bills over and almost tried and wanted Omar to lose her job over. They're literally on record saying, yeah, we influence Washington. That's crazy. I mean, these people are ridiculous. They are a parody of what we used to, I literally keep saying this, that what we used to make fun of politicians for being, you know, 50 years ago, they became that. They're so cartoonish today that they can't even recognize how bad it's gotten. Now, this article, by the way, the Intercept article was shared with me on Twitter by RTR Truth Media. So always credit where credit is due. Thank you for sharing that. Now, moving on from this topic, and as always, all of these things are interconnected in their own ways. I'm sure many of you can see that. This one coming from South Front in regard to the CIA and Syria. As we always point out, that the U.S. is in Syria for Israel's foreign policy anyway, and they're now staying there to protect Israel, as they've openly said. Now we have CIA conspiring with ISIS in northeastern Syria, according to Turkish media, which should immediately make you question. But I mean, I should even say that, because you guys know we should be questioning everything, questioning anything we look at, including what I'm saying. But coming from Turkish media, we should know that they have an agenda like anybody does. But we also have mountains of evidence that shows us the CIA has done this on countless occasions, working with ISIS. Now, the CIA is conspiring with ISIS in camps controlled by the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, in northeastern Syria, according to Turkey's pro-government daily Yeni Safak. Now, the report released on March 11th claimed that the CIA had questioned about 2,000 ISIS members, and 140 of them have been provided with fake passports and other needed documents. The terrorists who had received the new names were transported to Iraq. Now, interesting how this exactly aligns with all the different reports we've been hearing about. All of them. So they could have just picked up on the same news and made this up. But it seems more than likely that this is what we're talking. This is what's happening. The proxy force that we've been pointing out for a decade or more. Now, of course, this is far from the first time that this allegation has been made. And more appropriately, this is far from the first time that the U.S. has made deals that we can prove with the group they claim to be fighting. The group they use as the excuse to illegally occupy nations. This has been talked about on numerous occasions. From leaks coming out to people on the ground to defectors standing up and saying, yeah, we made a deal with the United States. There's ones of helicopters landing and moving. I mean, we've been talking about this for years. So it's ridiculous to think this is just some new, that, you know, assume that Turkey must be lying. Even if they didn't come up with this story, I think we were well aware that this is what's happening. Or at least that this is something they've done. I mean, we just talked about the story about the U.S. Army taking 50 tons of gold from Syria in a deal with ISIS. Taking Syria's stolen gold, or rather the gold that they made from selling Syria's oil, and stealing that, taking Syria's money in a deal with the very group they pretend to be there to fight. And we can't ignore the correlation with these, all these things recently happening, and now Turkey coming out with this, and, or not even Turkey, a journalist in Turkey coming out and saying, they just literally, the CIA just dealt with ISIS on the ground. Now, Yeni Safak also claimed that the CIA had declared numerous areas in Deir ez-Zor province a military zone and had closed civic movement there, which, you know, again, they're illegally occupying someone else's country. These areas are being used, apparently, to question important ISIS members, according to the report. Some of these terrorists are then moved to refugee camps in Al-Hol, Al-Rukban, and Hasaka. Al-Rukban's the one we've been talking about. So now there's reports of them bringing ISIS militants into these camps, and these are the very people we're talking about selling water to refugees dying of thirst, selling food to people starving to death. This is literal, and this is a U.S.-controlled camp. It's just disgusting. Now, the newspaper also mentioned a special facility created by the CIA in northeastern Syria with the same purpose. Now, Israeli, French, and British special services are reportedly involved. Not a surprise. Now, the report also addressed a poor humanitarian situation in the SDF-controlled refugee camps. Of course, this is what we've been reporting on. So now we have Turkey also chiming in and saying, we concur that what they're doing to these people in Al-Rukban and other camps are literally an internment camp. They're starving these people to death in wildly unsanitary conditions and not allowing them to leave. And now they're also reporting this. This comes in the course of a previous report by the International Rescue Committee, which said that just recently over 100 people died in or en route to these refugee camps. And of course, while we are discussing the CIA, interestingly enough, it just happens to be another story. This is the first tweet that I saw. The Spanish government is accusing the CIA of being behind an attack on the North Korean embassy there, breaking in, then assaulting the North Koreans inside. Apparently the goal was to get information ahead of the Hanoi summit. Now that is a huge accusation. And it turns out that it seems pretty damn obvious that this is actually what happened. And this is from Moon of Alabama. And by the way, this is reported by all kinds of different outlets. But Moon Alabama article says, who ordered the CIA to assault North Korean embassy in Spain? Not even saying maybe, but saying who ordered it? The CIA just broke into an embassy in Spain, the North Korean embassy, prior to the recent summit, kidnapped people, bound them, threatened them, and he wants to know who ordered it. So do I. Again, if you think for 1 second this is something the CIA wouldn't do, you're simply not paying attention. But think about what this means for the representation of the United States. Like, what does this show the world that we think we are? Or rather, that the government thinks they are, and by default, they assume that we feel. That they literally can do what they want with impunity. They can literally invade a foreign embassy on another foreign country's land and hold people hostage. I mean, this is crazy. But again, I think what this does, it shows you the reality. It shows you what we don't often see is what they really are behind the mask. Now, a group of men entered North Korean's embassy in Madrid, actually bound and gagged the staff there before driving off with stolen mobile phones and computers. And this is according to Spanish media that reported this. Now, of course, the Spanish media could be lying. Of course, the Turkish media could be lying. But how many times before we actually start to begin to ask ourselves, maybe some of this stuff is true, right? I mean, you know, everything's fake news until you find out it's real. But the Spanish media is clearly reporting this, and they're not happy about this. And they can't let this go. So this is going to continue to develop. Now, the embassy raid was no normal thievery, as Moon points out. There were 8 people in the embassy when it was raided at 3 p.m. local time. They were bound. Bags were put over their heads, typical U.S., you know, Guantanamo type move, and some were interrogated. The thieves left with computer hardware and the cell phones of the personnel there. Now, investigators from the Spanish Police and National Intelligence Center, the CNI, have actually directly linked an attack on the North Korean embassy in Madrid on February 22nd, specifically to U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. So then again, this is not North Korea. This is Spanish intelligence. Or rather, the National Intelligence Center, Spanish police, openly saying that we have proof the CIA did this. That is a big deal. Now, at least 2 of the 10 assailants who broke into the embassy and interrogated diplomatic staff, which is obviously a crime, have been identified and have connections to the U.S. Secret Service as well. The CIA has denied any involvement, of course, but government sources say their response was unconvincing, which is funny. So that not only do they have proof that they're connected to the CIA, but they've actually been able to identify 2 of these people with connections to the U.S. Secret Service, connections to the White House. This is probably one of the biggest stories so far that the U.S., and this is mud on their face for sure, and how they respond to this is going to be very defining, I would say. Now, the operation was perfectly planned, as if it were carried out by a military cell, according to sources close to the investigation. Again, showing you it wasn't just some robbery. The assailants knew what they were looking for, they said, taking only computers and mobile phones. And the Spanish services seemed to suspect that the sole point was actually to get information on Kim, I think it's Hok Chol, who was the newly appointed lead on the U.S.-North Korea delegation, the recent one that Trump just had with Kim Jong-un. So they literally wanted to get information on this man to maybe get a leg up on the negotiations. Now, as Moon points out, that may well be, though, I suspect that an attempt to find North Korea's diplomatic encryption codes was part of the task, saying basically that it may have been about this man, but he feels that it was more about the encryption codes. Now, he says it is not usual that a country will try to gain such information. Or not unusual, he says. What is very unusual is the brute force way in which it was done. And I agree, because how do they expect this wasn't going to get discussed? They said, was this to intimidate North Korea? Which seems more likely. Now he says, whatever. I can only think of one person in Washington, D.C. who disregards diplomacy enough to task the CIA with a military-style raid on a foreign embassy in a third country. His name is John Bolton, which I think is not going to come as a surprise to many, many watching this show. And it's sad to think that this is what we're doing. In our name, with our tax dollars, this is what the United States government is doing around the world. Again, it needs to wake some people up to what to expose the lies around altruism and humanitarianism that they use to cover actions just like this. Now, on that exact same note, on the two-tier system of our country in regard to the average people and the ruling class and just the lies surrounding all of it. To end today, I wanted to point something out that's upsetting, to say the least. And it's something that I've talked about a lot. Recently, it's been much more about foreign policy, but I've talked about this on countless shows. Just recently, Cardinal George Pell was sentenced to 6 years in prison in a child sex abuse case. Easily one of the largest, he is the highest ranking member in the church to have been charged and convicted. And this is a bittersweet story, because I'm happy to see him charged. I'm happy to see him go, and I'm happy to see him get more than a few months, like Jeffrey Epstein or like Dennis Hassert or like so many other people. If you don't know, Dennis Hassert was second in line to the president under George Bush W. And he was sentenced to prison as a serial child molester, got 15, was let out in 13. Slap on the wrist for such a serious crime. So I'm glad to see Pell getting 6 years, but that's not enough for a man who molested, raped, and abused untold amounts of children. Disgusting person. 6 years is not enough for such a case, but that's not the biggest point. And sadly, he's getting 6 years, and he's eligible for parole in 3 years. So it's probably even less than 3 years, but that's not the biggest story. I reported this just the other day. Someone tweeted this out. 2 weeks ago, a black Mississippi man was given 12 years in prison for possessing marijuana that he bought legally in Oregon. And here's a story they linked to. An Oregon musician who bought pot legally was resentenced. And this is the general story of this man. Patrick Beadle, 46 years old, in Oregon, initially faced up to 40 years in prison and had been sentenced in October to just 8 years in prison without parole under state drug trafficking laws. So charging with trafficking for a little bit of plant in his pocket. But understand that he got 8 years without eligibility for parole for a piece of a plant in his pocket, while George Pell gets 6 years, eligible in three. Does anybody else see an issue here? Now, Beadle was recently allowed to enter a guilty plea to just possession, so no longer trafficking, for the little bit of cannabis in his pocket. He was resentenced to 12 years after that, but we'll give him eligible parole in after serving three, which is a ridiculous shift. So basically, he got eight with no parole, and then they gave him more time and said, but maybe you'll get out in three, but that's up to us. The whole story is upsetting and ridiculous, but the reality is that we have a man who sentenced to 12 years in prison for a little bit of cannabis with no parole, got eight, and we have George Pell getting 6 years and out in three. We have to stand back and reflect on the problem there. Not just about pedophilia, human trafficking and abuse versus cannabis, but the ruling class versus the rest of us. The way they enforce the laws that seem to associate just with their circles versus the ones that associate more with our circles as the average individuals. It has to upset you. It has to get you riled up enough to stand up and say something. Stand on the soapbox and scream to people that this is not okay. That there's a problem here. And that we can all see it and we're just not talking about it. So I'll leave that for today. I really hope this woke some people up, and we need to begin to recognize more than ever the two-tier system in this country and how it just absolutely unjustifiably focuses on the average people. And of course, if you got the money, you don't get the time. Now, thank you for tuning in today. I appreciate all your support. Thank you for the super chat. If you'd like to support this channel, there's links in the show notes. You can do so on PayPal, Patreon, Bitbacker with cryptocurrency, or just sending cryptocurrency in general. I am wearing my Question Everything t-shirt today. If you'd like to support this channel by buying a t-shirt, you can do so in the show notes to the link to the Truth Clothing link, and you can get a Question Everything t-shirt or a sticker. Or if you want to buy anything else on this channel, on the website, there's a lot of good shirts on there. Make sure you put in the code Vagabond in the code area so we get the support for that. But thank you for whatever you choose to do, including simply just being here and spreading the word. As always, I love you all. Question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.